From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
This is a moment to wake world leaders up at night. The dramatic shelling of Europe's largest nuclear power plant of its type.
This has never happened before. A nuclear power plant has never come under attack like this. This is tank fire. This is not a terrorist trying to get in here. This is armored vehicles shelling a nuclear power plant. I cannot overstate how serious this situation is.
Even as the bloodshed in Ukraine continues, the twisted interpretation of values that the American political religious right has shambled into seems to allow the Vladimir Putin's deadly war while still celebrating his Canal Street knockoff family values. We're talking about Russia here, a country where wife beating and other domestic violence is expressly protected by law. An insightful analysis appeared this week in Religion Dispatches, penned by activist and Russia scholar Dr. Chrissy Stroop. We'll get a briefing from her later in the hour.
Most people who call themselves Christians do not believe the most basic doctrines of the Christian faith. Many people have solid enough statements of faith on their church's website, but they still have severely unbiblical church practices and beliefs seeping into their congregations.
Almost every week, we bemoan the contemporary hijacking of religious language and credibility in the service of an extremist political agenda. The evidence of this campaign is all around us, but what's in short supply is a reference point, an anchor to help regain and maintain a solid sense of what key Christian values, ethics, and morals truly are. An invaluable contribution to meet this need comes in the form of a new book, Introducing Christian Ethics, from ethicist David Gushy. This week, I'm looking forward to having Dr. Gushy back on our program. Spoiler alert, it ain't all just about crushing LGBT and women's rights. Not even close.
This is the most aggressive anti-LGBTQ action in the United States in the past 30 years. Hands down, nothing comes close. This is the state, a state government saying that it's okay for the state government to rip away trans children from their parents if they're given access to gender-affirming care.
Even as Florida charges ahead with its unconscionable Don't Say Gay bill, Texas is taking its life-threatening assault on trans youth and their families to even more extreme levels. At the forefront of raising awareness is the Texas Freedom Network. We'll hear from Executive Director Val Benavidez. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, know how much we thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now, to our first guest. Many millions of people are looking to the United States and NATO for leadership in this moment of unprovoked military crisis in Europe. While the commitments toward a solution our government and our voters are willing to make may be limited, the role American evangelicals have played in supporting the Russian threat, growing for years in plain sight, is undeniable. Chrissy Stroop holds a PhD in modern Russian history, spent years as a scholar there, and is a leading commentator on post-secular conflicts and political religion. All of this makes her the perfect expert to reach out to as we look at American culpability in the current war of Russian aggression. Chrissy, welcome back to State of Belief Radio. It's always good to have you here.
Thank you, Welton. It's always great to join you. I'd say it's a pleasure, but it's not exactly pleasant to talk about the Russia and Ukraine situation, though we need to do it.
Your Religion Dispatch's article is headlined, "Russia and the U.S. Have More in Common Than You Think." You bring personal experience and observations to this piece. What are the commonalities that you identify?
First, let me say that that piece was first published in Open Democracy and then reprinted in Religion Dispatches. So some of the similarities that I bring up in this commentary have to do with the kind of hyper-patriotism of sort of ordinary individuals that we find often in the United States and in Russia, a kind of patriotism that often goes to an unhealthy degree associated with visions of national greatness. People in the Soviet Union were always told that they were growing up in the greatest country in the world, while we here in America were also being told, in school and on TV and 4th of July ceremonies and everywhere else, that we live in the greatest country in the world. Yeah. I don't even think that it's useful to talk about what is the greatest country in the world. But, we have this history of having been two sort of rival great powers. And we also both have a history, Russia and the United States, of expansion westward to the American frontier in the case of the United States, and eastward through Siberia in the case of Russia, colonizing and enacting brutal violence on indigenous peoples. And I think those sort of things shape the mentality of people living in countries like that. And you have to sort of work against some of the biases that you internalize from that sort of thing. Neither Russia nor the United States wants to be particularly honest about our history. Russians also don't want to talk about the history these days of Stalinist repressions. They want to focus only on Stalin's victory in World War II. But a lot of times you just see this sort of thing, and I call it a sort of imperial provincialism, right? We've come from countries with these imperial histories, and the ordinary people who are of the sort of main ethnic group that's centered and considered to be the default in these countries, white Americans of European descent, especially Protestants, people who are ethnic Russian in the Russian state, tend to have a very myopic view of the world. Neither these kinds of Russians nor Americans particularly value learning foreign languages. And sometimes they even express aggression toward people that they hear speaking a foreign language on the street. You know, this is something that occurs in America. Some people are just walking down the street speaking Spanish or Mandarin or whatever. And some white American bigot says, "This is America. We speak English here." Well, I've seen the same exact thing happen in Russia. In fact, I've had it happen to me when I was riding Russian public transportation once in, must have been 2004, riding home from work, where I was an English teacher in Vladimir at that time with another English teacher. So both native English speakers. We both could get by in Russian. I think that was before I would really have called myself fluent, but we got by. But of course, sitting next to each other, we were speaking English. And so, well, this big Russian man in a leather jacket and buzz cut, saunters up to us and he said, "Вы понимаете по-русски?" Which is, "Do you understand Russian?" And so we said, "Da," And he starts reading us the riot act that we're speaking English on a Russian trolley bus. And there was another time when some friends and I, American and Russian friends, were sitting together going to a local agricultural festival. We were taking a bus from Vladimir to Suzdal, a beautiful old city with gorgeous, churches and monasteries. So they have a cucumber festival every summer. I think a lot of Americans from the South and the Midwest will understand the draw of a local agricultural festival. So we were going to the Cucumber Festival, and we had bought our bus tickets a little bit in advance. So we had seats on the bus, and a lot of people had standing room only. It was a crowded bus. Mm-hmm. So we're quietly talking to each other. And then here are these Russians standing next to us. And suddenly I overhear them saying in Russian, "Well, now look at these foreigners just coming here and taking our seats."
Yeah. you were in Russia during the first Russian tests of Western resolve against aggression. What was that like?
Yeah, that's correct. I taught at the Russian Presidential Academy of National Economy and Public Administration. It's quite a mouthful. It's even more of a mouthful in Russian, in Moscow from 2012 to 2015, excuse me. So when Russia annexed Crimea, again, right after the Winter Olympics, in that case, the Sochi Olympics that Russia was hosting, that's when they started sending the so-called little green men, listeners may remember, into Crimea, Russian soldiers not wearing insignia, to secure Crimea and take it. And of course, that was a huge violation of international law. It was pretty bloodless. But then, of course, they created these trumped up conflicts in the Donbass region of Ukraine. And that's not been bloodless at all, where, you know, these so-called breakaway People's Republics, the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics set up military resistance to the Ukrainian government. It never had majority support among the local populations. Yeah.
How did the divisions that you saw in Russia parallel those divisions you see in the United States?
So once that happened, you know, and Russia announced at the beginning of March the annexation of Crimea, and covertly Russia-supported war began in eastern Ukraine, I watched a lot of people around me in Russia, some that I considered friends, expressed their full support for the regime. Many Russians were shouting Krimnash, you know, Crimea is ours, was this big slogan. And it was really scary to just watch this sort of happening all around me. Now, I have a lot of good friends and colleagues in Russia who did not support the annexation of Crimea and do not support the war now. But some people that I really thought were reasonable and would see this as overreach certainly did not. And I guess I shouldn't have been surprised. But it did. It did shock me. And then, you know, in 2015, I was able to come home to the United States. Russia was also ramping up persecution against the LGBTQ community at that time, starting in 2012. And that was one reason that I wanted to go home. Mm-hmm. And then I get back here. I have a postdoc at the University of South Florida, and pretty much just in time to see the country elect Donald Trump and ramp up attacks against gay and trans Americans. And so I also saw a lot of people that I would have liked to think would have been better, more reasonable, more fair-minded, less hypocritical, you know, go for Donald Trump and his whole political program. And it was another sort of wake-up call. And I had that strange, disorienting experience twice in a row of, you know, wow, a lot of people around me that I thought were my real friends are ready to go fascist at the drop of a hat, it seems like.
Would you say a word or two about political religion coming into play in both countries related to the specific targeting of LGBTQI plus persons and rights in Russia and the U.S.? What are the parallels there?
Mm-hmm. There's parallels and, in fact, a lot of direct connections, because the Russian supporters of Putin and simply socially conservative Russians, Orthodox Christian Russians in particular, and the American Christian right have been collaborating at an elite level for a long time through organizations like the World Congress of Families, which has recently been renamed the World Organization for the Family, and it's currently run by Brian Brown, president of the National Organization for Marriage. Queer people are often able to be scapegoated by authoritarian people with majoritarian grievances. They're perceived as a vulnerable group that can be targeted. And in authoritarian communities, you have this real emphasis on machismo, you know, and queer people, of course, throw that just all into confusion for them. They want men to be men and women to be women, mm-hmm. and have a lot of very fixed and, I would say, pernicious ideas about what that means. It's interesting that at the beginning of the Soviet Union, you know, the early revolutionary years, there were a lot of efforts to really liberate women from patriarchy, but all that went by the wayside by the mid to late 1930s. And the Soviet regime was surprisingly patriarchal in some ways. Post-Soviet Russia is much more so, and is using Christianity to justify that patriarchal stance of women should be in their place and men should be men. And of course, that's also something that is focused on by the Christian right. You know, there's this council on biblical manhood and womanhood associated with, you know, Dr. Piper there, and people at the Gospel Coalition. They're all about complementarianism, which means that, you know, male headship of the family is the only appropriate biblical theology that you can have. They used to call it biblical patriarchy. They don't call it that as much anymore because they know it doesn't sound great. It's not good branding, but it's still it's the same thing. And so, yeah, they've been focusing their efforts on trying to make queer people invisible again, because we make them uncomfortable. And that takes the form of vicious legal persecution. Like, well, Putin has called, you know, giving transgender children access to age-appropriate medical care almost a crime against humanity, he said a few years back. And now we see the same kinds of arguments happening in states like Texas, where they actually have open child abuse investigations, trumped up phony child abuse investigations into loving parents who are supporting their trans kids.
Yeah. Christy, I want to bring us right into today and what's on so many people's minds. There are chilling reports of thousands of Russians being detained for participating in the anti-war marches. We've seen in the major cities there. How high are the stakes for these people for promoting the actual Christian message of peace?
Very high. And it'd be interesting. I'd like to take a poll, I mean, of who is in the protests, how many of them are Orthodox Christians and how many of them are secular. But yeah, I mean, certainly Christianity can make this case for peace. You're not going to see that from the hierarchs of the Orthodox Church, but you do see it from some good Russian Orthodox Christians, like my friend Sergei Chapman, who used to be the editor or one of the main editors for the official journal of the Moscow Patriarchate, you know, the journal of the Russian Orthodox Church. And he is not in Russia at this moment, which honestly I fully support. But there are a lot of brave people in Russia getting arrested. Russia's cracking down quite a bit on dissent. And in fact, the Echo Moskvy radio station, the Echo of Moscow, which has been a sort of staple of liberal commentary, pro-democratic commentary, for a long time in the late Soviet space and then in post-Soviet Russia, has now been shut down. And I doubt we'll be seeing that reopened anytime soon. It was already illegal in Russia, technically, to say that Crimea is part of Ukraine, though according to any reasonable interpretation of international law, it is. And now they're also making it illegal to frame Putin's invasion of Ukraine in any terms other than those promoted by the Kremlin. So we're going back to some more hardcore authoritarianism in Russia.
Are you able to speculate about the limits of support for Putin, especially if the Ukrainian resistance stays strong, and in particular, if the West comes together in a stronger way?
That's very difficult to say, but I think Putin will probably maintain majoritarian support for the war in Ukraine for quite some time, in part because a lot of Russians, even if they're going to complain about the sanctions, about the deprivations that the sanctions will be causing about their pensions, about inflation. Yeah, Russians will complain about all that, but many of them do buy into this sort of nationalist rhetoric and the way that Putin represents NATO and the West as anti-Russian threats, and also, you know, homosexuals and trans people and all of this as, you know, threats against the Russian way of life. Ukraine has become a kind of symbol of that threat. Putin is saying Ukraine making overtures to Europe and NATO is too far, and now he's got to put Ukraine in its place. I don't know. The divisions, people who have family in Ukraine, it may make a difference in how much they support Putin in this. But I think when the notion of national humiliation comes into play, it becomes very difficult for Putin to back down, and very difficult for, you know, your typical sort of quote unquote patriotic Russians to do anything but be supportive of him.
What do our listeners need to be thinking about in terms of religion in relation to this dangerous conflict?
Well, it's complicated because Ukrainians themselves don't even agree on which church should be the proper Ukrainian church. But it's quite clear that the Russian Orthodox Church, and at least its official circles and its prelates, they are supporting this invasion. And Putin is justifying it in terms of religious history. The Byzantine Empire, the heritage there, they just took the city of Kherson, which is where the baptism of Rus occurred, right, in 988. And the traditionalism that Putin thinks is at stake in this war is something that he represents, and the Kremlin represents as a religious value, very similarly to how the Christian right does so as well, and says that if we lose that, then we lose Western civilization. It's funny because Putin says if we lose that, we lose Russian civilization.
Kristy Stroup holds a PhD in modern Russian history and lived in Moscow for several years. Prominent ex-evangelical writer, speaker, and advocate, who is senior correspondent at Religion Dispatches and a senior research associate with the University of Innsbruck's Post-Secular Conflict Project. Her recent column, it is headlined, "Russia and the U.S. Have More in Common Than You Might Think," and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Kristy, great thanks for taking the time with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Lovely to speak with you, Welton. Thank you for having me.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, scholar David Gushee takes us back to basics when it comes to Christian ethics. And later, no end in sight for government-sanctioned attacks on Texas trans rights. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. Dr. David Gushee is a respected scholar who teaches Christian ethics at Mercer University in Georgia, the author of many powerful books. He has now returned to basics with his latest, titled Introducing Christian Ethics, Core Convictions for Christians Today. And as a good friend of David, and also as an ethicist in my PhD studies, I am really happy it gives us a chance to get together again on State of Belief Radio. David, thank you for being with us.
Welton, it is great to be with you again, and thank you for engaging the new book, for sure.
I think your lifetime of scholarship on this topic, combined with the widespread misuse today of what Christian ethics really means, makes this the perfect time for this book. What was your thinking behind this book and at this time for the book?
I would say that, I mean, there was an immediate cause. It looked like I was no longer going to be teaching the Christian Ethics Survey class anymore, and I thought, let's do one last, you know, new body of lectures, a kind of a last lectures paradigm was the idea, you know?
Yeah.
And then it seemed pretty early on that might make a good book. Mm. But I also think that a deeper purpose has become clear. You know, in the last 6 or 7 years, I have written, and a lot of others have written, about the disillusionment of a lot of former evangelical Christians in the U.S., right?
Yeah, right.
And one of the key buzzwords today is deconstruction. People are all about what they no longer can accept, what they no longer believe. And a lot of disillusionment. I think one of the things this book ends up doing is saying, well, here's what we can believe. Mm-hmm. Here's what we can stake our lives on. The subtitle, Core Convictions for Christians Today, is really important. I have core convictions that I've built my life on, and I think people need that, or they feel almost nauseated because they don't have any idea what to stand for or what to believe in. And so, in a sense, you might say this book completes a trajectory, or at least moves ahead a trajectory, for the post-evangelical Christians of America and the world. What do we now believe?
Hmm. Before we get to some core concepts, please talk about what Christian ethics is not.
Okay. Christian ethics is not just whatever your pastor says. However brilliant she or he may be. Christian ethics is not just a rule book. It's not just quoting the Bible. It's not just citing the tradition. It's not just giving an opinion. How about that? That's a pretty good list.
That's a good list. Do you think people are as vulnerable as they seem to be to misdirection because the study of ethics is seen as too esoteric and therefore inaccessible to most laypersons?
I would broaden that to say that I think that American Christianity today shows an alarming susceptibility to misdirection of all types, theological, spiritual, ethical, biblical, partly because of atrocious teaching in Christian schools and churches and families, universities and seminaries sometimes. Yeah. But also, there's a kind of a politicization of the church sweeping the land, so that people a lot of times not thinking in Christian terms at all. They're thinking more in political terms. Yeah. And so part of what I try to say in the book is that the Christian moral life, how we follow Jesus, how we live every day of our lives, has been a matter of sustained and careful reflection over many centuries. Mm-hmm. And we should join that stream of reflection and see where we find ourselves in it, instead of just making it all up as we go along.
Yeah. What would you flag as some warning signs that a misdirection is taking place?
Well, I would say one way to start with that is that there are like three main orienting categories at the very beginning of the book I talk about, and that is moral goals, moral rules, and moral character. So Christian ethics has always asked critically, what goals should our lives be directed towards? What rules set boundaries for our living? And what virtues are we supposed to be trying to develop, and what vices are we supposed to be trying to avoid? And there's not an infinite range of answers there. I mean, there is a tradition, and it's deeply rooted in Jesus's example, as well as teachings of Jesus and the rest of the Bible. There are boundaries there. And when you see people blowing past those boundaries because they're really taking their cues from TV shows or politicians or the politics of the moment, then there's reason to be worried. Just as an example, any form of cruelty is antithetical to the character qualities of Christian people. So when people casually speak with or embrace cruelty, like towards undocumented immigrants or Muslims or whoever your target group is, people of other races, or if they feel that the political other can be attacked without restraint, then we're not in the realm of Christian ethics anymore. We're doing something else. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times that's just completely lost as people are swept up in the passions of the political moment.
Yeah. So we want to get into the fundamental principles that you lay out in the book, and you may have already answered this. What's the foundation on which you build?
I would say the core claim of Christian ethics is that the Christian moral life is about following Jesus faithfully. That when we commit to be a Christian, we're not just joining a church or getting baptized or affirming doctrine. We're committing to a way of life. That way of life does not come naturally. It's difficult sometimes, but that way of life is signaled by the example of Jesus, aided by the Spirit of God, and we are instructed in it in the teachings of Christ and of the New Testament especially. And so the foundation, I would say, of ethics is a serious effort to follow Jesus, accessing all the most relevant resources to help us do that as faithfully as possible.
David, I have read your writings across the years. We've been on this show together for several times in which you talk about where changes have taken in your life. There are these foundations. And then what I want to ask is, where in your life and how and why did you make the changes that you made? What was it that said, I've got to rethink this?
I would say my ethical thinking in some ways has remained very steady, and in other ways has changed in some details. Mm-hmm. The changes have tended to be affected by pastoral engagement with suffering people.
Yeah.
And a great example of that is LGBTQ inclusion in the churches.
Yeah.
The repeated experience of the misery of people who discover that they are gay or lesbian or trans and then get rejected by their churches and families, finally, after a couple of decades, really 20 years as an ethicist, finally forced me to rethink that issue, and that was famously articulated in my book, Changing Our Mind, in 2014.
Right.
And my thinking has not changed on the issue since then.
Yeah.
Other issues, you know, it's like experiences with suffering have deepened my convictions. For example, like my book, and I've always taken a pretty conservative line on divorce. I think that divorce should not be casually entered into any more than marriage should be casually entered into. And my 30 years now of pastoring and teaching has only reinforced me in both of those convictions.
Mm-hmm.
That marriage is the most significant covenant that most of us will make in our lives, and that it is not to be entered into lightly, and it is not to be exited easily. And I actually think that the overall accumulation of human suffering, you might say, that I've encountered in ministry has only reinforced me in those convictions.
Mm.
So that's an example where I haven't changed on one issue and I have changed on another. But all along, the goal is, what does following Jesus look like faithfully?
Yeah.
And then for teachers and preachers, there's this other question. What does leading a community, what does leading Christians require of us, right? What do our responsibilities demand of us? For the first time in one of my books, I have a whole chapter on that. in this book about the moral responsibilities of Christian ministers. That's new. And those responsibilities are grave. And that also, that chapter was also affected by feeling like I've seen a lot of Christian ministers fail, not just in their personal morality, but in their leadership of their people.
Yeah. Would you talk about why a simplistic fundamentalist reading of Scripture can be a seductive, easy, but inevitably doomed approach to living a Christian life today?
That's a great question, Welton. I would say fundamentalism, let's say we associate it here with a rigid view of an inerrant Bible and a tendency to at least theoretically believe that all Bible passages carry exactly the same weight.
Yeah.
Right? And then also a tendency to dismiss other sources of insight and information that might govern how we reason and how we live. So, you have people unable to draw a meaningful distinction between the authority of the book of Joshua and the authority of the Sermon on the Mount when it comes to violence, right?
Right.
Or people who are unable to listen to clinicians and to human beings, including their own children, when it comes to the lesbian, gay, bi, trans experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
A flat Bible in which distinctions cannot be drawn between texts is a problem, and a Bible alone approach in which you can never learn anything from any other reality, both of those I think are characteristic of fundamentalism, and both of them don't work very well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I understand where fundamentalism comes from. I think it is fundamentally about a desire for certainty. And a desire for authoritative answers in an uncertain world. But the downside can be very, very grave, including a lot of people getting hurt, a lot of inadequate answers being proposed, and a lot of people leaving Christianity for both of those reasons.
Yeah. David, you know that I have walked where you're walking now at Mercer for really good years. And I have to ask you, when you discuss the issues with your students at Mercer now, what are the biggest challenges in the 21st century for people? Where are they having to grapple with the timeless concepts of the Christian faith?
I might draw a distinction between my seminary students who are studying for ministry up in Atlanta, mm-hmm. and my undergrads who are, 18 to 22 here mm-hmm. in Macon today, where I am.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with the latter. On the whole, they are suspicious of exclusivist claims of all types, right?
Mm-hmm.
A significant minority of them, at least, have had unhappy experiences in church and are not sure they want anything to do with Christianity.
Yeah.
The LGBT issue is part of it, but it might also be patriarchal authority and the substitution of Trumpism for Christianity in conservative circles in the South, where they may come from. They have to be shown gently in multiple settings that even that religion can be a positive force, let alone Christianity, or that the Bible has good and positive riches to inform their lives, so much less can be taken for granted than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Christianity is not taken for granted. The biblical authority is not taken for granted. The wisdom of the church and its leaders is not taken for granted. You have to kind of show, like I teach this class on great moral leaders, and today we're talking about Bonhoeffer.
Mm-hmm.
By showing lives like Bonhoeffer's, you can show what healthy, vibrant Christianity can offer and what it opposes, what it can counter too, right?
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes only really sturdy discipleship can say no to evil, like in the Hitler years.
Yeah.
And so people, they get that. But it's a challenge because the starting point is, let's say, not especially hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In addition to reading your book, what are some resources that you would point listeners to who wish to recenter themselves in their understanding of Christian ethics?
Oh, wow. There's so many good resources. An earlier book that Glenn Stassen and I did called Kingdom Ethics.
Remember it well. Really good book.
Remains valuable. That's out in a second edition.
Yeah.
There's grand ethical voices in multiple traditions. Like if somebody wants classic African-American Christian ethics, you might go to Peter Parris of Princeton. On the Catholic side, I love everything that Lisa Cahill of Boston College does, you know. In womanist ethics, I love everything that Emily Towns and Stacey Floyd Thomas do. In Latinx ethics, there are a number of great voices, but I especially like Miguel de la Torre and Ruben Rosario Rodriguez. It's a feast.
Yeah.
And a lot of great works are cited in my book. It's a kind of a select bibliography, but if somebody were to start there in the new book, they would have a pretty good library to get started with.
Well, that's a good way to start with what you've just said. What else should people keep in mind in understanding what benefit these principles can bring to today's turbulent world?
Well, you know, there's five chapters in the middle of the book that that caught the attention of my friends at the International Baptist Seminary in Amsterdam,
yes,
where I am also teaching. And they're doing a whole conference on these principles in May, and they are truthfulness, sacredness, love, justice, and forgiveness.
Mm.
So the whole conference is on that. Now, why are they doing that? Because they concluded that those five principles can be a source of orientation and even of unity in a fractured world. I think a lot of what goes wrong I think on the liberal side of Christianity, what can often go wrong is we are too scared to give you any direction whatsoever because we don't want to sound judgmental or authoritarian.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
What can go wrong on the conservative side is the opposite, but we're going to give you authoritative direction based on our reading of a handful of passages, right?
Yeah.
These centering norms, like the sacred worth of all persons, justice, love, and so on, transcend specific Bible passages and apply to every issue. They transcend casuistic reasoning, and they're like the points of a compass that can put us in the right general direction, you know, in relation to how we live our lives every day, in relation to any specific issue. Ask, what does justice require? What does love look like? What does it mean to treat people with dignity? And so on. And so it's that orientation that we need. And we need a community of people who agree that these are the orienting points, and we want to live within those parameters. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing the church is supposed to be.
Yeah. Dr. David P. Gushy is Distinguished University Professor of Christian Ethics at Mercer University. His many books include Still Christian, Following Jesus Out of American Evangelicalism, Changing Our Mind, a landmark call for inclusion of LGBTQ Christians, and the just published Introducing Christian Ethics, Core Convictions for Christians Today. David, it's always good to be with you and always learn from you, and you also have inspiration along with that. David, thank you so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's great to see your face again, and great to be in conversation with you and with your listeners.
It would be bad enough if more and more states picked up the political football Republicans have turned LGBTQI plus lives and identities into simply because it works at riling up the base. But even worse, they keep advancing the ball down the field, finding new and brutally cruel ways to deny the reality of queer existence and demonize anyone who bases their approach to LGBTQI plus issues on mercy, empathy, or, you know, science. A breathtaking new attack is emanating from the Texas Governor's Office of all places, and I am grateful to be joined by Texas Freedom Network President and Executive Director Val Benavidez with the details. Val, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. Thank you so much for having me today. I'm really happy to be here.
What is Greg Abbott up to on transgender youth?
What we feel like the governor, the lieutenant governor, and the leadership of Texas is doing is abhorrent. The fact that he has given directives to a state agency to investigate transgender children is absolutely unacceptable and not legal. This opinion that, you know, Attorney General Ken Paxton gave is an opinion. And we are seeing it create chaos, confusion, and fear and direct attacks to transgender families in Texas right now. I think what you said is very true. This notion of red meat to the base, and it's horrific. It's horrific that red meat to the base in any scenario would involve assuming and not even assuming, just falsely believing that a parent would not be doing everything in their power to care for and love their child and working with the medical establishment to make the best decisions that they can for their families.
So, Val, what are the implications for parents of trans kids specifically?
So right now where we sit, the Department of Family and Protective Services has started doing investigations into transgender families and those who are receiving care for their children. This is horrifying. In one case, it was an employee of the agency herself who asked for guidance as she is working with her own child on receiving care. And she was placed on administrative leave. And luckily, the ACLU and others have been able to start the legal process in the court system in Texas to begin moving this through the courts. And so what has happened is there has been a temporary restraining order granted for the family that they were representing in this suit. And they hope to now move forward with expanding a TRO statewide. There'll be another hearing on this next week. And then my assumption is this will move through the Texas court system at that point. But for families directly, there's a couple of things. One, it's important that families understand that it's not a law. This isn't a law. There's a lot of confusion. People believe this is a law. It's not. And that two, they are right to be asking questions and to be joining into some of the trainings that are being offered by the ACLU, by Lambda Legal, by Equality Texas, right now for parents and families to understand what they should do if someone approaches them or their families. So I would advise people to do that.
Val, this is insane.
It is.
A party that claims to put parental rights first on religion, on firearms, on every other issue is blatantly invading the family on this one. How is this being justified?
It's not okay. It can't be justified. And it will take all of us. TFN is lucky to work with such great faith leaders and faith communities across Texas, but it will take voices of faith to come forward to remind everyone that we all are God's children and that we have learned these lessons from our faith leaders that have taught us to love our neighbor, to care for all, that everyone in the image you are is perfect, and that we continue to need to hear that from people of faith. It is a time when we are all being called to stand up and to be vocal and to protect these communities that are under vicious attack, and to remember that this same Republican Party has done this for other communities as well. We watched a couple years ago as we all banded together as undocumented people were being targeted in Texas, and they were not allowed. They were not safe. There was a massive mobilization in the immigrant community to be that they were the people who were bearing the brunt of those policies then. And we see this happening again and again in community after community. And it is absolutely unacceptable. And anyone who calls themselves a Republican should understand that what they are doing goes against what the goals of their party claims, and that they are, in fact, tearing families apart in this work.
I see this as the governor, along with his attorney general, literally criminalizing science. Is that overstating the case?
No, not at all. You know, when I think about doctors, I don't think of them as being a rowdy bunch of activists in the world. Yeah. I think of them as being very scientifically minded, very conservative in their medical approaches, very much detail oriented, taking in massive amounts of education and factors and trying to work with parents to make the best possible plans. I don't think of doctors as a giant group of political activists. And I think the fact that we have moved down this path with COVID, with other things, and this false narrative around science as being somehow not valid is really disturbing. And, you know, I just want to tie this together to other things we're seeing now, whether that's the censorship in public education, what we look at when we see what's happening at local school board levels, also using LGBTQ stories as a wedge issue. But I think what people need to understand is it doesn't just start and stop with this community. When you actually look at the list of books that people want to ban, it's stories about the Holocaust. It's stories that are told by brown and black people, you know, about their personal experience in the country. It's not. So just I really just want to make sure that people understand that we're all in this same boat together, and that we need to stand up for all communities, because it really this is a moment that really, really matters.
Thank goodness for Texas Freedom Network. Talk about going to court.
Yes. So I would want to rightly first center two organizations in our coalition in particular, and that is TENT, the Transgender Education Network of Texas, and Equality Texas, which is the statewide LGBTQ advocacy organization in the state as well.
Good. Thank you.
I would want listeners to understand that if there are donations to be given, these are two of the organizations in Texas that need the support and who are right on the front lines. And we are so proud to be in a coalition called the Equality Coalition, where we do this work with them and with the ACLU, with Lambda Legal, with the Human Rights Campaign, and others. And so that effort, as this moves through the court, we will take our lead, obviously, from the attorneys at the ACLU, Lambda Legal, and HRC, and do everything we can to support making sure that people understand what is happening and that we're providing the best education and access to resources that we can, while making adamantly clear to the governor that this will not stand and that we will do everything in our power to fight these horrible, horrible directives he has given.
Now, I want to be clear, are medical societies and other scientific associations taking part in exposing this madness? Because this campaign aims to criminalize the work of doctors and other care providers, as I understand it.
Yes, and I do think that we will see more of that in the coming days. I think in the immediacy, we have seen what is happening with DFHS directly with investigating families. And I do think there will be a push to attempt to access records from medical establishments, and it will be important for medical establishments to refuse that. And I do believe that, you know, we've seen the Biden administration weighing in on this. We're seeing Health and Human Services nationally weighing in on this to provide specific guidance around privacy. And it's important to remember that the medical establishment has to keep medical records private and also has to provide care in an unbiased way to all of the people who seek care.
Hmm. How prominent is the political religious right in pushing these oppressive policies?
I mean, if our leadership is representative and emblematic of that movement, then very prominent. And so I believe we will continue to look to see that. You know, we've seen this being pushed. We've not, you know, not this issue directly, but certainly what's happening in censorship, what's happening in other places, what happens at the Capitol. I can safely say that that feels very much aligned to me. This was a bill that the governor tried to get passed during the legislative session, but failed to do so, and the lieutenant governor as well. And so we are now seeing this in a different version, which is why this is happening. And we are fearful of what other ideas for the next legislative session there may also be. So it's important for us to fight as hard against this as we can and get to a place through the courts.
I have to ask, what kind of support are you getting from religions?
We are getting support from communities of faith, from the faith leaders that we work with. They were at the press conference with us this week. They come to the Capitol. They put on their stoles. They remind people of the values. And I think it's really important for as many people of faith to recognize that they have a role in this, and it's much needed. It's much needed and it's much welcome, and more of it needs to come.
I was going to ask you to be sure and tell our listeners some of the other things that you are doing.
You know, I think things that are happening right now are ways people can be involved is to support the organizations like TENT, the Transgender Education Network of Texas, and Equality Texas. Follow their feeds. Follow what is being put out by the ACLU and Lambda Legal and the Human Rights Campaign, HRC. Make sure to get involved. If you are a person of faith, lend your voice, right? Be able to move that forward. And, you know, one thing that I think is really impactful is to directly tell the members of your community that you know who are transgender or have transgender family members that you support them, that you love them, that you support their families, and that you're willing to fight for them. That is something that people need to hear in this moment. And then that needs to be backed up with activism, with donations, with support, with coming forward. And, you know, we're a civic engagement organization. This matters at the ballot box. It matters to make sure that everyone in your community is getting engaged, is registering to vote, and is showing up in all of these spaces.
Val Benavidez is president and executive director of the Texas Freedom Network. Val, thank you so much for all that you are doing in so many ways. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Thank goodness. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and in company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See, Welton.